time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 21st of April 2012. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua. On Saturday, the 21st of April, Sharon Brown talked to Gramya Alonzo Barth about Gazing with Braco. She spoke to Hugh Ross about the Aotearoa Not For Sale March, and Nicole Foss and Lawrence Boomit on peak oil.
Well, we're just going to get right into Island Life. Here we go. Great. Well, here we are on Island Life. There's heaps of guests coming in today. So first up, we've got Gramya, who's involved with lots of sort of natural health and healing. And it's quite intriguing because she had a post on Facebook this week, which suggested that we maybe go to your house and be involved in some gazing. So 6 days... At 7 gazes a day is 42 gazes. So I'm quite intrigued, Gramya. Tell us all about the gazing.
Good morning. Well, gazing is something I also didn't know what it was until the story starts a year and a half ago when I received an email from a friend in Australia saying, check this out, this guy is gazing. And I opened the website, and I started reading, and I saw his photo, and I started reading things about it, and I started laughing and laughing. And I had such a joy coming into my heart. I couldn't stop. I went to bed, and I couldn't stop laughing for 2 hours. And it was so amazing. I thought, so much light, so much love, so much joy. So,
and this was from a photograph?
From a photograph in the website, and just reading his website.
He does have very nice eyes. I saw his photograph on the website and I thought, oh my goodness. Yeah, it's quite limpid.
So then January last year, January 11, my partner and I went to Los Angeles for work. We went to visit Baron Katie. We did the work of Baron Katie. So she was there and we had to do something with her. And after that finished, I saw that Bradshaw was in Los Angeles for 3 days. And I go, oh my God. So I went there and I spent 3 days in his gazing presence. So he just walks in the room and for 5 to 7 minutes, he just gazes. And there were 800,000 people in the room. There was a big hotel.
So there were 800 people in the room?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a big hotel. And he came every hour in for 5 to 7 minutes, and he gazed to the people, and all kinds of things happened. Well, for me, the main thing, I just feel so much joy and love for everything. It's like a deep feeling, everything is okay. It's like a relaxation inside. It's beautiful. And then people after the gazing stand up and start giving testimonials of what changes happen in their lives.
And from the previous 5 minutes or in general because they've
in
been
general,
following
or from the while. Just 5 minutes just that happened or the day before because it was 3 days. A big huge black guy stood up and he said, I came here 2 months ago or something and I was addicted to caffeine. I drank 40 coffees a day with sugar and cream and I could not stop. I came to the gazings and the next day I didn't have any withdrawals or any wanting to drink any more coffee and stopped. And I have not had any withdrawals since then. And this was just a tiny thing. You know, many, many, many people stood up and gave their testimonials. So what I love about Bradshaw is that he doesn't teach anything. He doesn't say anything. It's a silent hug. He watches and it's like loving hug that comes towards me, you know. And I think that because of that love, the people feeling that, the love in the room is so, you can touch it almost. And this vibration, that in that vibration, things dropped. These people who are organizing him made DVDs, and in the DVDs are many, many testimonials of also people who heal cancers, for example. It was one woman that she was going to die. The doctors were going to, you know, say goodbye to your children. And somebody gave her a ticket and said, come and see this. And 1 week later, the big tumor she had in the head reduced 80%. And 1 month later, it totally disappeared. That is 2 years ago, and that woman, she comes sometimes in the thing, is totally healed. She is nothing.
So what
there.
Makes him so special? I mean, you know, people talk a lot about the importance of gaze and looking at each other. It's often an acting exercise to make people connect more. It's often a, therapy type of exercise where people look at each other to try and connect with each other better and develop a warm feeling. So what makes him so special?
I think that he has a gift that he never asked for and he didn't want it, I guess. I don't know. I tell you a little bit of his story then. When he's from Croatia, and in Croatia he has like 10,000 people coming a day to see him. The story started when his mother, he was very young, he was 26, his mother had a migraine, and she wanted to see that healer. And Bradzo said, what, you're going to be the gypsy healer? I'm going here to protect you. And he went with her, but he got so impressed with what he was seeing, with that other healer that was called Ibiza, who now is not, he died, that he kept going to him. And then when Ibiza passed away, there were thousands of people there. Somebody said, the people were saying, well, who is going to help us now that Ibiza is gone? And a woman looked at him and said, you are going to do it. I saw it in a dream. You are going to the next one. And he said, I don't know anything. I don't do anything. No, you. Please touch the photo of my child or something. And he did. So he said, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm doing nothing. But it's a gift that comes through him. And I think because he's so humble, so simple, so normal, then he is giving way to other things coming through him. And then, and the people start coming more and more, thousands and thousands, and giving testimonials of all these things happening. And then that's what happened. Then they invited him to Switzerland to a Congress of Healings. And it was incredible, the impact there. Then somebody saw there from America and invited him to America. And now they are making him travel all over the America giving these gazes.
So he's very well known for his gazes. And yes, apparently you can also, if you listen to him, you can also be healed by listening to him. But I was a little bit confused because on the website it says he hasn't given a public talk in years and years and years. So how would you be listening? Are these old recordings or just people, the paparazzi sneak up on him and get a few words of him saying, I need to buy some milk, and then they,
He talks normal. He has a wife. He has a kid. He talks with friends. He's just a normal guy. He doesn't talk in public about any healings. That's what's happening.
Why is that? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't know. The thing is that he has his center in Croatia. He's from Croatia. And because now he's traveling so much, all the people from Croatia who was going there to see him, he doesn't want to leave them without anything. So he recorded in purpose a 10-minute talk in Croatian with this intention for them. And that's the voice, that's called the voice, and that's what they play when he's not there in Croatia, and that's what has the same effect as his gaze.
I see, okay. Because it's very powerful, isn't it? Because they say that you can be in the room and see him gazing, you can see him through the internet and watch him gazing, and then you can also, he can also look at a photograph of someone and that person will also be healed.
Yes, so, and I don't know how it works. Don't ask me. Mm-hmm. This is a mystery, an energetic mystery, and it happens. And it happened to me. I mean, I was thinking one of my brothers in Argentina who had a terrible thing, going to a doctor to have some examination, and then I just thought about him. I wish him well. And then my sister called me the next day and said, "Did you do something? I cannot believe it. You know, our brother, blah, 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 blah. And it was just total change, and it was everything fine, and he was in a good humor, and everything went absolutely fine, which was totally unusual for him. So little things like that, you know.
So, Grammy, you yourself do some healing?
No.
But you're involved in some other healing processes?
My partner and I, we are the only certified facilitators of the work of Byron Katie in New Zealand. So we run workshops and we give sessions per Skype all over the world or in person in Waiheke. And it's a very rewarding work because the changes on the lives of people are amazing, and I love that.
And so what's the key features of that work, the Baron Katie work?
The Baron Katie work is a meditation, is investigating your stressful thoughts. Because Katie says that the only way we can suffer is when we believe our stressful thoughts. And so she has these questions that inquire into these thoughts. And we don't give any answers, we don't give any therapy, we just ask the right questions at the right moment, and the people find their answers and the truth inside themselves, and that what sets people free.
Because we have, so it's a sort of a sounding platform for your own ideas, so you work through your own problems but have some opportunity to talk about them.
It's not even that, it's inquiry if they are true, your stressful thoughts. And it's very powerful when you discover that they are not. But nobody can tell you that. You have to go through the process. It's an experiential process, and you will find your truth, and that's what's liberating, and this is amazing. Yeah.
Okay. And so this you put this thing up on Facebook for Brazzo, come and join you to do some gazing. Have you had much interest?
Yeah, I have people coming. And also in the website, I explain how you can do it yourself in your own home. It's just $3 American you pay, you go through it, you pay, and then you have it in your house.
Is there some sort of additional benefit from group gazing? Or, I mean, obviously you'd be saving the $3, but is there some sort of collective energy?
I don't even know that. I just know that it's my pleasure to move this in any way I can, and I love that.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's one more thing I do is the Oneness Blessing.
Yeah.
Yes, and also I am in the Bruno Circle of Friends. And all these things, I'm in all of them because I know that always help in one way or another. And I like to promote everything that is positive and healing and loving. And I know for some people work one thing, for one some other people work some other thing, so I like to open all the roads so everybody can benefit from whatever fits with them.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yes.
Great. We've got Thomas in the studio as well. Thomas, did you have any questions around gazing? I know you were quite intrigued by the whole process.
I'm certainly intrigued by it. Grammy, how does Brazzo affect you? What does he do to you?
Okay, as I said, the first time I saw it, I just couldn't stop laughing. I felt so much joy and lightness. And now since I have... Well, when I went to America and saw him for the 3 days, I was just flying. I was just flying.
And does do you keep having the same effect? Or does do you get tolerant of it like a narcotic? Or
no.
It's always the same every time?
I never took any drugs, so I don't know the comparison. But I don't have any problems in my body, basically, and I'm quite healthy. Because I do the work, I don't have much stress in my life. The work of Byron Katie, I do since 10 years. I don't have much stress in my life at all. But this Brazzo adds a joy, a lovingness, an easiness.
Sure. Well, you've invited me to one of your sessions this morning, so
yeah,
I'm going to be
come.
Popping down to Palm Beach. Can we turn that phone off, maybe? Or? So I'll be coming down to Palm Beach. I'm going to be checking out one of these gazing sessions. I must admit, I do come at this from a somewhat sceptical point of view.
There are many, many sceptical in the audience there. If you see the gazing, you will see so many skeptical people, it works anyhow.
It works anyway. Okay.
Anyway.
Thank you very much for coming in, Grammy. That's been really interesting.
Thank you for inviting me.
I look forward to seeing the session later on this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Great. Okay, well, that was Gramia talking about gazing, and here we've got it, the Rolling Stones' Loving Cup, to put us in the mood of gazing. So when's the next gazing session? 11 o'clock today.
11, and then at 1, and then at 11, 12 and 1.
Perfect, great, thank you.
Wakey Radio.
Well, so next weekend... there's a big protest against asset sales in Auckland, and Hugh Ross, who's been quite involved with making some of the posters for that, is here today. Hi, Hugh.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Sharon.
And okay, so can you tell us a bit about what this protest is all about?
Yeah, well, essentially, it's Aotearoa Not For Sale, which is a kind of a loose alliance of people who are concerned about... the sale of state assets, the mining, the kind of like ideology of unrestricted foreign investment in New Zealand, and all the things that come along with that. And I think the core group, which I'm not a member of, I'm just like a spectator or a groupie, I imagine, and I've been involved in trying to do some of the postering around Waiheke and in the city. The core group grew out of the Occupy movement in Auckland, so it has kind of like it resonates backwards into the fallout from the global recession and implications of that.
Right, lovely. So what's happening on the protest?
Basically, essentially what's going to happen is 3 p.m. That's Saturday, 3 p.m. next Saturday at Britomart, and it will march up to Aotea Square.
Lovely, good.
And it's just—I would just like to point out that you know, it's not just about state asset sales, and it's not just about the sale of, you know, farmland to China. It's, you know, it's a lot wider than that. It kind of involves the whole concept of economic sovereignty in New Zealand and the privatisation and this of everything, like schools and prisons, and also and incorporates, you know, like, as I probably talked about before on your show, the implications for multinational mining of New Zealand resources, which is going to start happening in quite a serious way quite soon.
Mm. So one of the things is that the national government, it's their second term in office, they stood on a platform of asset sales, and they were re-elected on a platform of asset sales. So isn't it pretty much what the New Zealand public want to, you know, they elected the national government, that's what they said they would do, and now they want to go ahead and do it. So what's the problem?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, they did this, and you can't deny that they did have asset sales as one of their platforms, and you can't deny that they actually do have a one vote majority in Parliament. But I think that the issue of asset sales is much wider and much more structural to New Zealand economy and the direction that we're going to have to choose to take one way or the other than just a one vote majority in Parliament. And yes, they have been elected, and yes, asset sales was part of their platform. However, I don't think that asset sales is something that they have, as they claim to have, a mandate to do. You know, this isn't about changing the left-hand giveaway rule. This is about the sale of our economic sovereignty, and it's about kind of unleashing foreign investment into our economy in a way that's going to be a tsunami, and we need to all be really, really careful about where that's going to take us as a nation, because we're going to start losing control. With the National Party, as well as like selling state assets, which is just part of it, selling our land, selling our resources, privatising our prisons, privatising ACC, they're also in the process of signing the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is just another kind of like opening in the dam of our sovereignty, which is going to give multinationals the right to come in here and have more power over our environmental control legislation, have more power over our labour protection legislation than our own government. And if we, as a country, or as a, maybe we have a Green Labour Mana alliance next elections, if they choose to make changes to legislation that is, you know, in defence of our economy, in defence of our environment, in defence of our economy, and that happens to impose on the profit-driven agenda of multinationals who have signed up to the TPPA, then we'll be taken to court and sued for loss of profits. And so this is just another way that National is undermining our economic sovereignty. And so all these issues, you know, they're all overlapping. So the Aotearoa Not For Sale isn't just about sale of assets, and it's not just about sale of farmland to overseas investment.
Mm. And it's also accompanied by a bigger hui, isn't it? Or is it part of a bigger hui? I wasn't sure. Yeah, there's something else going on, isn't there?
Yeah, no. So there's also a hikoi that's being run by Mana. So a hikoi is essentially a march or a path of progress, and that's leaving from Kaitaia, and we'll be joining the march next Saturday, and then the hikoi will travel on to Wellington, which will be then there'll be like 4 days of seminars in Wellington around all these multiple issues.
Okay, great. I mean, we've got an interview with Nicole Foss later on in the program. She talks about peak oil and the financial stability of the financial system, and she talks a lot about the importance of economic sovereignty. That seems to be a term that seems to be emerging more and more. And
living
locally and having control over your assets, because of course the other thing is that if you have large-scale foreign investment, you also get asset stripping, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, the thing about foreign investment, or in, it's not even just foreign investment, it's like investment even by you might call them local investors, but if you have a large corporation, no matter where they're listed on the stock exchange, they're essentially at the beck and call of their shareholders. And, you know, there's also this idea that corporations have a legal commitment to maximise profit. Well, maximising profit doesn't actually always go hand in hand with what's beneficial for our community and what's beneficial for our nation. And kind of like this neoliberal economic idea that government should need to be kind of relegated to the dustbin and the market will make decisions that are for the best of everyone is just nonsense. And it's been proven by the kind of like the corporate Wall Street mafia that have destroyed the entire...
Okay, get him off.
But it's true. I mean, we need to start thinking about communities and nations as sovereign entities, and they having their own responsibility to take charge of their own direction and not be dictated to by corporations. Whether that corporation is called the United States of America or Wall Street or Fisher and Paykel, we need to have control over our resources, our land, and the direction for our country.
Well, that seems to make sense to me, but okay, great. Well, thanks for that. I was hoping that Scott Ewing might be here to talk about the event next Saturday, but perhaps we can just talk briefly about that. So there's an event next Saturday, the 28th, and then again on the 4th of May, which is Theatres of Resistance, and that takes place from 2 till 6 on both days with slightly different programmes. It's been done to coincide with Labour Day. There's a little notice here. Silence is consent. And yes, so hopefully next week someone will be in to talk about that. And there's going to be poets, musicians, short plays and skits, speakers, and it's been organised by Carol and a very active group of people. Great, thank you very much. So that was Hugh Ross talking about the protest next week, which starts at 3?
3 at Britomart.
3 at Britomart. And it's a family-friendly affair? Lots of, you know...
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Anyone can go?
Absolutely. Yeah.
They're not going to get tear gassed or riot police aren't going to come out?
No, not this Saturday coming, no. Okay. That might be in our future, though, if we
right.
get it together.
Something to look forward to. Okay, great. Great, okay. Well, the last guest on our show the last guests on our show are Nicole Foss and Lawrence Boomert. I recorded them earlier in the week. Nicole Foss is a systems analyst and the senior editor of The Automatic Earth, where she interprets financial data and makes some predictions around the current global economy. She's also got a degree in law, and she's an expert on the effects of, peak oil, and thinks a lot about climate change. So she talked a little bit about some of those things and how it might play out in Waiheke. It's about a 35-minute interview. There's also Lawrence Boomert, who talks for part of the time on alternative currencies. He comes from Golden Bay, and he's been very successful in setting up an alternative currency for the Golden Bay area, which includes about 10% of the population. And so I leave you with that interview. Some of it is a little bit hard to get your head around, but it is quite informative, and there's some particularly interesting things around the use of personal assets and new ways of thinking. That's what struck me through it, and how the island might be affected by peak oil or a global financial crisis. So I leave you with that, Nicole Foss and Lawrence Boomert.
Very pleased to be in a beautiful place that does have some special circumstances. Islands are inherently different in many ways. The kind of isolation that islands have, even if they're not very far away, there is an element of isolation. And that does mean that certain economic factors end up being more pronounced or less pronounced in island areas. So I look at a place like this and I think, well, there are elements where the island is going to be more resilient because there's more community and people are more used to living in a small place. But at the same time, because there's been a large element of people buying property as holiday homes, an awful lot of that could end up on the market all at once when the property bubble bursts. So there will be impacts on the property values for the island as well, and impacts on what can and cannot be brought here at different times when trade relationships start to get more difficult in challenging economic times.
Mm. So you've written a book, you're a senior editor for The Automatic Earth, and your key skills are in interpreting financial data and predicting things around the global economy and how that's going to affect us if there's a crash. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you talk about is a deflationary depression, which could cause demand for energy to go down, which could create further shortages and less growth. Do you think you could just explain how that process works?
Well, basically, we focus on finance at the Automatic Earth because it has the shortest time frame, because we are on the verge of a serious financial crisis. Began in 2008, but it's not over. We've just had a period of reprieve. But we're moving into a period of financial crisis. And because the time frame is short, that has been our focus at the site. So what we're looking at is the bursting of a bubble that took 30 years to inflate. When bubbles burst, they produce economic depressions. So the kind of structure, the way to think about this, to conceptualize it, is to think of a giant game of musical chairs. During the expansion phase of a bubble, what happens is you have more and more creation of multiple claims to every little piece of wealth. So you have this much collateral and this many loans backed by that collateral. When the loans go bad, people start to reach for the collateral. In other words, while we're participating in our game of musical chairs, people don't notice how little there is to go around, how few chairs there actually are. When the music stops, people all grab for a chair, and the people who do not receive a chair are out of the game. So the excess claims to underlying real wealth are extinguished as the bubble bursts. This is what we're on the verge of at the moment. Right now it's centered in Europe with the sovereign debt crisis and all the problems with the single currency. But that dynamic is going to be spreading. What happens when credit crashes is the money supply crashes. This is deflation by definition. This is the kind of thing that happened in the 1930s, where we crashed the money supply, which is the operating system. Finance is the interface between human beings and the natural world. When you crash the operating system, the economy has a period of economic seizure, where because there's too little money in the system, you can't connect buyers and sellers, producers and consumers. Trade tends to collapse. Things don't move around the way they did before, and things don't work at a large scale anymore because the trust horizon contracts. So anything that is beyond the trust horizon no longer functions effectively. So what I'm trying to do really is to encourage people to build resilient local structures at a small scale. An island like this is ideally placed to do exactly that, to live within its own resource base, to be less connected to the larger system that won't work as well as it has done to deliver what it used to before.
Things then is, how can we as a community, or how can communities become more resilient? What kind of specific strategies have you got in terms of how people keep their assets, how they use their money?
In generic terms, I think to psychologically prepare is the first and most important step, and hence why I've been so enthusiastic about Nicole's tour, is that she's helping people psychologically and rationally prepare for what comes next. Informed is better than not if you're on the Titanic.
And so basically what we need to do at an individual and a community level is to get out of debt, because the burden of debt will be enormous, to not be dependent on credit, because credit is going away, and gain control of the essentials of our own existence. So when it comes to what assets we have, to have as close a control over those assets as possible, so not to be dependent on the solvency of middlemen, build systems at a local level where the supply lines are short, if it's a business where the customer base is local, so you know you'll still be able to get whatever it is you need. You know that the people you're serving are the people who are close, so you don't have to have these long, long chains. And when we can build that kind of local resilience, which will very much include local financial systems, local currencies, for instance, in order to keep things moving when the larger system is not working very well. We can do that, then we simply restore the kind of control at a local level that allows things to function. Because when larger systems are breaking down, becoming chaotic, and are not delivering what they did before, we need to reclaim control at a local level, and that can be profoundly helpful.
Hmm. So, Lawrence, how do your notions of developing a local currency fit into that?
Well, there are a lot of different systems that you can use. Off-the-shelf models like time banks and LET systems, local exchange trading systems, which use fairly sophisticated electronic platforms. Some use paper vouchers or paper currency, like we do in Golden Bay. People can use swipe cards if they want. I mean, money is very much a human construct. It's easier today than ever before to create good platforms for monetary systems.
And so you've had a really successful experience in Golden Bay. Can you tell us about that?
Well, now on 10% of the population are members of our local currency. So we've got 440 members, a huge range of products and services. And it's become a cornerstone, not just for allowing livelihood and income, but as a real central focus for all sorts of community building, as a real valuable tool for connecting with each other and building a community of reciprocation and trust, because we're exchanging with each other. We've had successes in things like our adult education service. The funding was cut up and down New Zealand, but unlike most communities that lost that, we used our local currency to actually strengthen and grow our adult education.
So how does it work? I mean, on a practical level, how does it work?
It works just like money. It is, unlike all sorts of other creative or alternative systems, our LET CES system is very much just a model of other money, except it's totally locally focused. And that is that we have an accounting system, like you have a banking accounting system for your own bank accounts, and you can draw on cash out of it. You can use cash, or you can use electronic transactions, and so you have a balance. We issue credit straight away to create liquidity in our system. Any member that we feel trustworthy, which we're very trusting people in Golden Bay, we issue 500 credits to people, but there's no interest, and that's a key thing. There's no usury on the system, so there is liquidity because money represents all sorts of things in our community. It represents the products and services that people give to it. So it's just like money, except it's our money, and it doesn't answer to foreign banks, and our focus is on what it does for our community.
And how do you get people to buy into it? Do people have to buy into it, or they just want to, or what's the... because at a certain point in certain people's minds, it'll be like, well, we're providing a service for free until we can cash in on something else. Or how do people buy into a monetary system that's not the official monetary system?
They join as a member, yeah. It's a membership-based thing, and then they go in the directory.
So do you think it was possible in Golden Bay because people are already attuned to the need for something like that?
It has similarities to Waitaki in that way, is that it's a community that's used to having to function sort of with an internal awareness of the needs and looking after each other in that way. So yes, and we had a lot of intentional community people come there and the like.
It's basically a question of what assets you have, having them as close as possible, so that you don't have things that are plugged into the larger system, which are going to be vulnerable. Because there are so many excess claims to underlying real wealth in the system, if your assets are in the system, then you may find that you wake up one morning and you don't own them anymore, because the great collateral grab has seized them and made off with them while you were asleep, as is already happening in some cases to customers of brokerage firms in the States, for instance. So there are a lot of issues with assets in the grip of the system. If we can maintain local control, then we can protect what we have. And the biggest problem here is going to be the property bubble, because the level of household debt here is very, very high. And people are going to find that the assets they thought they had are going to get revalued a lot lower, but the debt will stay where it was. So one of the things I suggest to people is to get out from under property-based debt. If you can't own something outright, it's better to rent, which means paying someone else a fee to take the property price risk for you, rather than to own and then find the value of the asset has collapsed and the debt is still where it was, because then people end up losing the physical assets they thought they had. It's far better to have what small amount you can own with no debt, then you know that you can still keep it. So it's about providing security, about not being overexposed. To use a Lord of the Rings metaphor, Bilbo described himself as feeling like stretched, like butter over too much bread. That's the situation we're all in today. We're in a situation where we are overcommitted to too many things. We had to borrow money to have everything that we wanted to have, that we felt we needed to have to keep up with the Joneses. We're now enormously overstretched. So it's a question of consolidating to say, what can we actually own outright? And even if it's not an awful lot, if you own it outright, you get to keep it. So moving from being overstretched to being within our means is incredibly important, both individually at a community level, as a country as well. New Zealand as a whole is enormously overstretched by being plugged into export and import networks so strongly and being so dependent on those, when those links are going to break down in a period of economic depression. So that applies at the larger national scale. It also applies to the smaller scale in Waiheke, where you are very much connected into a broader system that you depend on for selling things to, getting things from. And when those links break down, you really need to have the control over the absolute essentials, even if that's all you can have, just the needs rather than the wants. If you can have control at a local level, that makes an enormous difference.
It's a huge ask, though, because it's a complete change in mindset. I mean, New Zealanders are used to striving to buy their own house and owning it outright, and it's almost the only source of wealth creation for some people is the belief that you will eventually own your own home, and that will increase in value, and so somehow you'll have a nest egg for your old age.
That's very much characteristic of the expansion bubble years. And people do have a sense as a result that property only ever goes up. It doesn't only ever go up. And in fact, it's going to be falling by, my prediction is about 90%. When the bubble bursts, and it's much bigger than just a property bubble, of course, it's the financial system bubble. We're going to crash the money supply when credit is eliminated. And that is going to completely knock price support out from under the property market. So the system that has worked for a long time is on the verge of breaking down spectacularly. When people can't get mortgages anymore, the pool of buyers will be composed of the people who can afford to pay cash and who choose to use scarce cash for that purpose at that time. That pool of buyers will be incredibly small. The property values will end up at best case scenario where they were in the 1970s, which is approximately a 90% reduction. This is very typical of the bursting of the bubble. When you eliminate what will probably be 99% of the money supply as credit crashes, you eliminate price support to that extent. So the people who have that mindset of needing to get on the property ladder and this is the route to wealth are going to be just horribly disappointed. Really, people who are taking out mortgages now will never be able to pay them off. Their ability to earn a living will be very sharply compromised. So their access to credit disappears, unemployment goes through the roof, savings may disappear if they're caught up in a systemic banking crisis, and at the same time, the level of debt stays where it was before. So it's a perfect storm in financial terms. People who are overcommitted with debt are going to find that they lose the assets they thought they had. Now, if you do own a property outright, if it is entirely yours, then that's not a bad thing at all. If it's a good place to be stuck and it has productive capacity, there's no problem being stuck there. But if you own it with debt and the property price collapses and the debt stays where it is and you can't service the debt anymore, you just end up losing the asset and then you end up with nothing. So I'm trying to get people into a more secure position. For a lot of people, this will mean renting rather than ownership. And I understand this is an enormous shift of mindset, but people are incredibly vulnerable at the moment and don't even realize it. So they need to move away from that mindset that's characteristic of where we've come from, but very much not where we are going to.
Have you done much around collaborative buying power? Because I know in underdeveloped countries, that's like a big thing that you pool together. I know in Peru, they had a sort of a financing scheme for cars. So you'd pool together and then a series of families would buy one car between them.
I'm a keen fan. There's a book by Rachel Botsman. You can see a 16-minute video over on TED on YouTube. And she's written the book, What's Mine is Yours, The Rise of Collaborative Consumption. And it's a really exciting revolution in the way people are rethinking the way they buy, sell, shops, share, reciprocate. And that what people are finding is that either within their own communities or even globally, people are actually willing to trust each other and even have people into their own homes, like the millions of people belong to couch surfing. People are doing it for car sharing. They're having car sharing. I don't need to own a car by myself. So cooperative structures will increasingly be proved to be the most effective model in these times. It makes people feel more secure. It shares risk. And it's a very strong model with great precedents all around the world. And there's a lot of, it's a really creative time for reinterpreting all these relationships and how we can do it. And there's some very sophisticated tools, and it's a changed mindset. And it's quite fun, because we've been force-fed this neoliberal agenda for the past 30-plus years, that it's Darwinianism 101, dog eat dog, get out of my way. It's the most efficient way is survival of the fittest. And it's just bullshit, through and through. And it's proved how effective it is, and it hasn't been effective for a good result at all for most people on the planet. It hasn't even made them happy either.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think pooling resources to own something collectively is absolutely the kind of answer that you need to take, whether it's homes or tools or all sorts of infrastructure. That way we're not exposed to the system. We're not being used as engines of credit creation. We're not overstretched. We come together to own something. And then we end up being much happier because of the interconnections between us, but we also are much more secure because what we own collectively, because there's no debt, will not be taken away from us. Mm. So that's very, very much the kind of model we need to move towards for a whole range of things. Mm.
So, Nicole, you talk a lot about sort of community resilience, individual resilience, taking responsibility for, you know, the way we live. But what's the role of government in all of this? I mean, one of the things that strikes me in what we're saying is that we had, you know, a waste minimization process and a locally owned and run garbage disposal and processing facilities, and the council made a decision, a minute fraction of what we were able to do and what the community had come together to provide for themselves. So you're almost competing with the government on some of these things.
Yes, because the government isn't going to be able to deliver services in the way that it has done. So all the things that come from the top down that are organized at too large a scale, where the trust horizon will contract, political legitimacy will disappear, effectiveness will go away. A lot of the things that are currently delivered by government and by larger structures are just not going to work at all. So it is a matter of building something that initially will be competitive with that system, will be not competitive in the sense of being able to outcompete it in financial terms, but competitive in that there will be two parallel systems. And it is a matter of building something else from the bottom up, because for exactly the reasons you suggest, when you scale things up, they become less accountable, less responsive, less effective in delivering what actually matters.
Mm. Have you got any sort of strategies or ideas or success stories on actually dealing with government to allow local community resilience? Because I think what happens sometimes here is that you have a whole group of people who are interested in community resilience, think it through, develop projects which are really sound, for example, the whole waste clean stream thing that we had. And then that is completely undermined at the government level. So what is it that we should be, how does one prevail on government, and what should we be expecting from them to help us in this process?
Well, I think one has to distinguish between different levels of government. I don't expect anything to come from national government that will be helpful at all. Municipal government, maybe, depending on the extent to which they're informed and committed to local accountability. It can be a partnership between the bottom-up and the top-down from a local government level. And what local government can most effectively do is to remove barriers to people looking after themselves, because this builds resilience rather than destroys it. Unfortunately, where local government is more bound into the national system, or looking upwards rather than downwards, it really doesn't work. Now, the national government system, because it's not going to function effectively when it's completely starved of tax revenues, as it will be, and no longer enjoys political legitimacy, I tend to regard national governments or large-scale top-down structures as dinosaurs. The rest of us are mammals beavering away at the feet of the dinosaurs, and the things that come from the bottom up are going to be the future. Yes, there's a period where it's difficult to compete with the very large existing structures, but they are currently getting enough rope to hang themselves, and they're simply going to cease to function in the way that they have done. And it'll be what we've managed to build in the meantime at the bottom-up level that will take over and will grow to whatever level the trust will support. So I think this is really the future. I'm not looking to change the existing system. I'm not looking to expect anything good to come from the top down. Unfortunately, all too often, the job of national levels of government ends up being to make a bad situation worse as expensively as possible. And so I'm really not looking for solutions to come from the top down. I think that scale simply will no longer function, and we have to work at a scale that will function. Initially, that means having a foot in two worlds and doing all the work of both and not enjoying all the benefits of either. It's difficult to make that transition to go from where we are to where we would hope to be. But I think we can do that. It's a lot of effort, it's a lot of work to change mindsets, to build resilience, but I think it can be done. And eventually it will be the evolutionary successor to the system that we have. When the system we have falls flat on its face, what we've built in the meantime is what we will have to rely on.
Mm. And there's a window of opportunity. There's the biggest window of opportunity for change. Is that we have to suffer in the current system as it is, but inevitably it will become untenable, that situation. And it's a shame, because central and local government, of course, could have done so much. so much to help get everything we need to be ready for this and adapt and resilient, and they haven't. I, however, do think that at some point central and local government can offer a lot. I'm a little biased because I'm just with Deirdre Keane, who wrote Healthy Money, Healthy Planet, launched the New Economics Party, which is based on basically the two platforms, radical monetary reform and transition town preparation, so we can use a national platform to encourage relocalisation. But at a local government level, they will have to change. In a 1930s style situation, they're going to have peasants on the street with pitchforks, and they won't be sending out council officers anywhere to inspect infill housing or alternative systems, because their officers just won't go out of their buildings when people are in that much hardship. And also
they themselves may not be being paid, which is what the situation is in Greece.
So my colleague Deirdre has actually written a whole paper on how local government, which we presenting to Auckland City Council members as well, on local government-backed currency. And so there will be those things to put on the table that can be implemented. Because I think I'm a keen fan of civil society and later, you know, building on the Hellenic tradition and all the rest of it. I don't want to go back too far if we can help it. It's a great window of opportunity. We'll have to change. Mm. And a lot of these things that all of us have been working on for ages will have a flourishing in these moments. Just as when an old growth forest, the big old trees come down, and it may seem like a terrible time. It's all coming down, but that's when the new forest just springs forward that's been building all this time.
That's very helpful.
Ecological succession.
So one of the things you've spoken about in terms of the consequences of fracking in Canada is this notion of a Faustian bargain. So can you explain a little bit about what fracking has done or the effects in northern Canada?
Oh, it's not so much Canada that I focus on. It's really the issues in general to do with the kinds of things you can do to get a lot of energy now at the expense of creating the potential for enormous environmental destruction later on. And this has been the story of an awful lot of energy production. We take risks or we create environmental pollution in order to have energy now, and we don't worry about the consequences of what we're doing. The same kind of description can be applied to, say, nuclear power. But in the state of fracking, what you end up with is a scenario where you can end up with a lot of pollutants in your groundwater. You can potentially end up setting off earthquakes, which is not a nice thing to consider when you actually live in a pretty active seismic zone in the first place. And I just look at what we're doing, the risks that we're taking without understanding the geology that we work with in many cases, to look at the risks we take for the sake of getting a little bit of energy. Now, those risks are very large, and when you look at how much energy we hope to get, you also have to compare that to the energy you have to put in to get it. The net energy of unconventional gas production is actually very low. So in other words, you're putting in almost as much energy as you're getting out. So the risks that you're taking for the sake of producing a very, very small energy surplus. Yes, there's quite a lot of gas in these unconventional gas structures, but we are not getting very much energy above and beyond what we had to put in. So the risks are being taken for very small energy profits. Now, in some parts of Canada and the United States, there's so much methane that ends up in the groundwater as a result of fracking that people can set their well water on fire. There are places where the aquifers have been really heavily contaminated, mostly as a result of leaking well casings. But there is also the potential for broader water impacts than that when you frack in areas where the geology is not well understood, particularly where the strata, the rock strata that you're fracking, are very heavily faulted. So there are some parts of the world where that is much more of an issue than other parts. If you have very stable, well-understood rock strata, then the risks of fracking that can be lower. But I look at what's happening in, say, the northern U.S. in places like Pennsylvania and New York State, where they're fracking very hard rock strata, where the geology is very poorly understood, where it's very highly faulted rock. And so you don't have to have a leaky well casing, because the contaminants can simply flow up through the fault lines and end up in the aquifers. A lot of the chemicals that are used for fracking are highly toxic. You could do it with simply water and sand, in which case it's just a pressure wave that you're creating. But they use all kinds of toxic chemicals as well to reduce the algal formation. They use biocides, all sorts of things in the fracking system. And so when you do that, and you're working in poorly understood strata, the risks you take are much, much higher. And in those places, these are very highly populated areas where the population is entirely dependent on these aquifers. So the risks are, we're taking bigger and bigger risks all the time with things like fracking. And we're taking risks we don't even understand for the sake of a very small energy profit. And in fact, more often than an energy profit, what's actually driving the development of the industry is a monetary profit. So what's happening is, if you can convince people that there's something enormously valuable on the land that you have leases on, then you can sell that land for a lot more than you paid for it. In other words, it's a property bubble by another name. So what's happening, certainly in the States, is the development of an enormous Ponzi scheme in land leases for shale gas properties. And this is the driving dynamic: profit in the short term, monetary profit, not even energy profit, not energy, not creation of a new energy source, but the creation of hype that allows people to make a very large monetary profit in a short space of time. So this is being done for short-term profit at the potential for huge environmental risk. So we're having the privatization of large profits and the spreading of enormous amounts of risk. I think this is why I call it a Faustian bargain. It's a deal with the devil, so that you make a lot of profit for the few in the short term, at the expense of letting the long term potentially go completely to hell. So an enormous range of people could be very heavily impacted, just so that a very few people can make a very large profit right now. And I think this is absolutely not the way to go. We really should be learning to live within limits, rather than reaching for all the short-term profitable opportunities that are currently out there. Now, one of the strategies for dealing with this is simply to delay as much as possible, to force geological studies, to force a true understanding of the environmental impact, so do a lot more research work. Now, if you can do this, one of the impacts of doing a lot of study work is to delay a project. If you delay the project to the point where you are in your period of economic contraction, then it will no longer make economic sense to do this. Delay it for long enough and you will remove the profit motive. Because what happens in an economic depression is that the costs of the product fall, because demand is falling. When people can't afford to buy the same amount of energy they did before, a lot less economic activity, a lot less demand, the price of gas in this case, and all other resources as well, will fall. The price will fall faster than the cost of production. Margins will be squeezed. In other words, it will no longer deliver enormous Ponzi scheme profits into the hands of the few. If you can delay long enough to the point where the economic case falls apart, because it's a short-term economic case, if you can delay long enough for that short-term economic case to fall apart, then it won't happen. So delay can be as good as preventing it. So you don't have to necessarily fight it from the top down in the way that people are currently doing. If you can simply engineer a delay in the interest of environmental responsibility. So this is not an artificial, unneeded delay. It is a delay to deliver the goods in terms of environmental responsibility and accountability. That delay will also quite likely have the effect of preventing the project from occurring, because the economic case for doing so will be so drastically undermined. And personally, I think that is something to apply to an awful lot of projects, like, for instance, the enormous road building that people are contemplating. Road building here is unnecessary. Traffic peaked in 2005. It's been decreasing since then. It's in the interests of the road building lobby, who will make a lot of money in the short term, to build roads that are unneeded, when that same amount of money could be going into building real energy infrastructure, like boosting the rail system, getting the freight off the roads onto the rail system in order to deliver a lot more value for the money. Build public transport systems. You know, don't build enormous projects that deliver profits into the hands of the few at the expense of creating debt and liabilities for the many. This is happening across New Zealand and everywhere else in the developed world as well, whether it's building large, flashy infrastructure projects that will do nothing but create a huge burden, like the stadium in Dunedin, for instance, or the library that they're contemplating building here in Waiheke. We have a perfectly good library already. Why borrow enormous amounts of money to create something that will be an enormous liability that will fall on the shoulders of local people? The people who are building it will make a lot of money in the short term. Everybody else will be left picking up the bill for years and years and years. So it happens at a local level, it happens at a national level, it's happening internationally as well. It's all about privatization of profits and socialization of costs. This is the dynamic we were on, the trajectory we were on during the period of expansion. It won't work anymore when we move it into contraction. And we need to delay as many projects as we can to the point they will no longer be economic. Then we will not incur this tremendous public liability just to profit the few.
So just very briefly then, when do you expect this period of contraction to start? I guess it's already started.
It began in, 2007. It began the end of 2007. That was when we first saw the contraction start. 2008 credits started to contract. This is why we had a financial crisis in 2008. There's been a bit of reflation since then, since early 2009. We're now tipping over the edge again. Europe is imploding at the moment. Huge credit contraction on sovereign debt risk, and an awful lot of collateral grab going on as the countries of the European periphery are being asset stripped. This is happening right now. It is going to spread. There are going to be financial shockwaves spreading around the world. And that's definitely going to end up here over the next few years. So we're looking at something that has an impact potentially this year, but certainly within the next few years. I think the deleveraging, the elimination of excess claims will probably happen over the next 5 years. And so there are going to be some quite significant short-term impacts as we see the collapse of the last 30 years credit bubble. The collapse takes much less time than it took to blow the bubble, and so we are going to see that impact in our own lives right now, starting right now over the next few years. There's already the beginnings of the property bubble bursting here, so the impacts are already reaching New Zealand and Waiheke Island. If you look how many properties are on the market right now, if there are 5,000 properties on the island and 800 of them are featured for sale in your local property supplement, how many more are not featured? You probably already in a position where a third of the properties on the island are for sale. It's going to get much worse than that. So that whole dynamic of excess inventory and the collapse of values is already underway. And it's going to get significantly worse before it gets better. So this is happening right now. People need to prepare themselves right now for what is coming. We don't have a lot of time to engineer a different kind of reality for ourselves. We'll have to be very realistic about the scope of what we can hope to achieve. But if we start now, we can achieve a significant amount before the larger scale systems actually cease to function.
Oh, very interesting. So, Nicole, do you ever get accused of scaremongering and painting a really bleak picture of the future?
Well, there have been people who did say that, yes, I'm Chicken Little, or yes, I'm scaremongering. It's very rare, though. It tends to be something that happens in the media. So I've seen media coverage of my tour trying to be balanced by assuming that the truth must lie somewhere in between what I have to say and what the mainstream position is. And this isn't really balance. Simply averaging out two radically different understandings of the world does not deliver you any greater truth. But this is typically the way the media approaches balance, unfortunately. Nobody ever stands up after hearing one of my lectures and tells me I'm making it all up or I'm scaremongering or any such thing, because I really build a very solid case for my view of how the world works, where we've come from, and where we're going to. I'm more than happy to discuss it with absolutely anybody. So I have very long question and answer sessions following my talks all the time. I will answer any question on any topic, integrate complexity in all its forms. So whether it's finance, energy, resources, geopolitics, population, carrying capacity, human psychology, community, I will integrate it all. I will answer questions that deal with part of it, all of it, anything together. And anyone who would like to argue with me is very welcome to do so. I welcome the challenge.
Well, Nicole, thank you very much for spending this time with me on Waiheke Radio. It seems like we've only hit on the tip of the iceberg. But good luck with the rest of your tour. I'll be following you and finding out more about how we can prepare for peak oil and the changes that are ahead of us.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.